spoke about methods of torture, they still exceed the imagination. And what we currently see is just part of the suffering that Palestinian detainees are grappling with in Israeli jails. That was concerning the interrogation phase. In the next stage, and after a forced confession is written, the detainee could be sent from cells to another place that we call the big prison. There, he sees his fellow detainees and begins a new life compatible with the prison's laws, which are set by the regime's authorities, who place each four or five people in a 2x2 or 2x3 meter room. There are also larger rooms, such as 10x5 meter rooms, in which 30 to 40 prisoners are placed. Then the prisoners are diverse. That was what I had to say in brief about the issue of the torture of detainees.
I mean, it's so unbelievable and so heartbreaking hearing what the prisoners go through because of the Zionist regime. And recently, a statement by the Palestinian Prisoners Club said detainees are being denied medical care, not transferred to clinics or hospitals in case of medical emergency. Is it because of their protests against the inhumane prison conditions?
While we are in a state of war, all the laws have changed. Despite its ugliness, the occupation ultimately adheres to the law of the International Committee of the Red Cross or some international and human rights bodies in order to appear democratic and civilized. But all the masks have fallen amid the ongoing war. There is no democracy, there are no human rights, no humanity in the Israeli regime's dealings. So we see it innovating new torture techniques for the sake of deterrence. The regime used to insult to obtain forced confession. But now, and amid the war, the regime aims at pressing the resistance. The regime uses the scenes of the arrest of women and children in order to press the resistance to submit to its demands. Then they want to obtain what they failed to obtain through weapons and explosives and through murders and physical assaults by pressuring the fighters when they witness the mistreatment of their women, children, and people. That is a means of pressure and a dirty war. Any war has its own means, such as a means of destruction, such as bombs and weapons of mass destruction. But the other means is to torture the civilians who are not involved in any operations in order to press the fighters to give up and raise the white flag. The more dirty method is that occupation deprives people from food and water. In northern Gaza, we have famine in every sense of the word. There is no edible thing there. There are more than 60,000 pregnant women who have nothing to eat. How will their fetuses be nourished? Dozens of fetuses die in their mothers' wombs, and those who are born alive find no milk or drink. The babies have nothing to eat and subsequently die. There are cases of child deaths due to malnourishment. In prisons, we knew the meaning of hunger because we went on hunger strikes to restore our rights that the prison's authorities deprived us from, or to protest against punitive measures adopted against us. Sometimes, we didn't eat anything for a month or 2 months, so we felt pains, including in the head and the knee, and grappled with weakness. After 2 to 3 weeks, the hunger striker becomes unable to stand up and walk, and instead remains in bed. Thus, hunger leaves people collapsed. The case now is not concerning a number of hunger strikers in prisons, but concerning an entire nation that is suffering. More than 700,000 people in Gaza have no food. Israel also destroys medical facilities such as hospitals and medicines. There are no medicines in Gaza. There are 10,000 cancer patients in Gaza, and they have no medication and are dying slowly. Regarding the normal cases, we have over 350,000 patients who don't even have access to a Panadol tablet for the headache, let alone those whose legs or hands have been amputated. How will they be treated? Many of them see their bodies decompose. And when a decomposed part of their body is amputated, another part begins to decompose. So they cut the other part off after a week or so on. Someone told me that he buried his father in three phases as his father's hand and leg were cut off during a strike on their house. So the son took them and buried them under the ground. Later, that same family was targeted in another strike that amputated his father's second leg. So the son took it and buried it in another cemetery. The father later died due to those injuries. So the son buried him for the third time. Can you imagine that a person can be buried in three phases? Where does that happen? All of that take place amid the world's silence. I mean, the entire world, including human rights organizations and the United Nations, all their meetings are fruitless. That's because Israel is the spoiled son of the United States. Israel is the U.S.'s dirty tool in the region. So we fight for the sake of our dignity and in order to restore our land. No matter the price that we pay, that will remain little compared to the restoration of our dignity and the preservation of our land and sanctities. God willing, we will move forward on the path until the end.
Earlier this month, a human rights group cited shocking testimonies from recently freed detainees, including the Israeli military, inviting settlers to watch the gory torture of Palestinians. On the other hand, we saw how Israeli captives spoke highly of their captors. I mean, what does this say about the two sides?
I spoke about part of those scenes, but there is another tragedy. These are settlers. Settlers have violated the remaining part of the Palestinian land, going beyond the part granted by the world. The world gave Israel a state and gave Palestine a state, but it was not established. Day by day, settlers steal the land. The disaster is that the settlers burn and rob the houses and attack the Palestinians and do whatever they want, while the Israeli army does not move a muscle. The army sees everything. What hurts more is that the army brings those settlers to the prisons to see how Palestinian detainees are humiliated, or subsequently they boost the morale of their people and settlers through showing them the pains of the Palestinians who are held in the prisons. That's humanly unacceptable, and those people breached all the limits of humanity, and we shouldn't even call them human beings.
Some reports have pointed to an alarming spike in so-called administrative detention since October 7th, mostly minors who were held without charges or without trial. How would you describe this travesty of justice?
The detention process is divided into several sections. I spoke about the first section, which is the interrogation and investigation into cases and operations carried out by Palestinian fighters who strive to restore their land. But there is another kind of detentions in which no interrogations take place, and subsequently the detainees are not subjected to related torture. However, they experience another kind of suffering as the detainee is imprisoned without charge or interrogation. Administrative detention is originally British. When Britain was ruling Palestine, it created administrative detentions. Later, the Israeli regime inherited that policy from the British. Under that policy, the detainee is imprisoned without a charge for 6 months that could be extended for another 6 months and later for another year and so on. Some people were jailed for 18 to 20 years under the administrative detention policy just because the regime's authorities suspected them, without evidence or proof. That's the height of crime. No other part of the world uses that policy. In fact, Palestine is the sole occupied country in the world. All the countries have been liberated, except Palestine. In Palestine, all inhumane laws are practiced. Many people were jailed under the administrative detentions, and that policy was not used against just 5, 10, 20, or 100 people. Before the Al-Aqsa flood operation, there were over 1,000 administrative detainees. But after Israel launched a brutal arrest campaign, the number of administrative detainees exceeded 3,000. They include doctors, engineers, ordinary people, and university students. Even minors are jailed under the administrative detention policy. I also want to mention one of the ugliest practices that I just remembered, which is the unexplained death of people in prison. Since October 7th, 11 people, including administrative detainees, died under torture. They were killed during just 4 months. Isn't that kind of insane? In return, you saw how Palestinians in Gaza treated the Israeli captives. They treated them humanely and shared their food with them, according to the Israeli captives' testimonies. We saw a released woman carrying her dog. While people in Gaza have no food, her dog was in a good condition. So the way Israeli captives are treated differ from the way Palestinians held in Israeli jails are treated. In Palestine, the Israeli captives are treated humanely, despite the war and destruction. In the Israeli regime, which claims to be a democracy, you see the height of ignobility.
At the same time, there are also heartening stories about detainees engaging in creative activities inside jails. For example, Bassem Khandanjik recently released his book, A Mask in the Color of Sky, written inside of a jail and nominated for an international prize. Where does this never say die spirit come from?
Sometimes the individual who loves the life never submits to pressure and always looks for ways to develop himself and convey his message to the world, even from the prison. The big prison to which the detainee is sent after being interrogated is a school where the detainee learns from the professors who are also imprisoned. Imprisonment is an ordeal, but we turn it into a granting. Some people were illiterate when they entered prison, but they left it with college degrees. Some people memorize the Holy Quran in prison. We turn prisons into schools and universities. We reached agreements with universities in Gaza and Lebanon and contacted them through professors who are held in these prisons. That has helped educate the Palestinians. Palestinians are by nature intellectual and love knowledge and dissemination of science. So we saw them writing books. The book that you mentioned was nominated for an international award, so its author gained fame. But there are hundreds of other people who authored books while in prison, and their books are released and just need to be interpreted into English and other languages. So we turn the ordeal into a blessing through investing in knowledge and education inside these prisons. There were 11 brothers who got a PhD degree while they were in prison. Each year, about 150 people get a master's degree either from Gaza University, Palestine University, Jinan University in Lebanon, or other universities. So the education process is ongoing in prisons, despite the attempts of the prison authorities to prevent detainees from learning. These attempts include tearing up papers and breaking pens. We even went on hunger strikes for more than 45 days in order to obtain a book, pen, or a notebook. So we were grabbing our right to education. At some point, we even forced the regime to give us access to some specializations in Hebrew universities. They only gave some of them that access with the aim of changing their ideas. Some experts in Hebrew affairs learned Hebrew inside prison and studied in Israeli universities. The Palestinians are heroes and generous. The Palestinian nation pursues freedom and knowledge. Like other nations, we want to preserve our dignity and freedom. We are the sole country in the world that's still occupied.
Thank you very much for being with us here on Hidden Files, Sheikh Talal Abdulrahman Sharim, a former prisoner of the Israeli regime and the head of the prisoners' files for Hamas. I appreciate you being with us. Thank you for being with us on another Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
The Deputy Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Sheikh Naim Qassem, says there is no option but armed struggle to fight off the open aggression that the Israeli regime is exercising in the occupied Palestinian territories and elsewhere in West Asia. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. The top resistance leaders of Lebanon and Palestine assert that it is necessary to remain steadfast and work tirelessly to achieve the promised victory against the Israeli regime. The Secretary General of the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, and the Secretary General of Palestine's Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhale, held a meeting recently. During the meeting, the two resistance leaders discussed the latest developments in the war-torn Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank, encompassing both political and on-ground situations amid incessant Israeli brutal attacks against the people of Palestine. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah and Ziad al-Nakhale also exchanged views about the condition of other fronts opened by the axis of resistance in support of the Palestinian people and resistance in the face of the Israeli regime. The discussions also touched upon existing possibilities and expected developments, whether on the battlefield or in political communications. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah warned it would expand the anti-Israeli front in the south in the occupying regime escalated its acts of aggression against the Lebanese territory and the Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Nasrallah praised the sacrifices of resistance fighters and said, "The wounds and blood have generated real achievements for our people and our country. Our responsibility is to preserve these achievements." On Israel's months-long savagery in the besieged Gaza Strip and the regime's sporadic shelling of southern Lebanon, the Hezbollah leader said, "The existence of Israel is a disaster for the entire region, and a fearful and deterred Israel represents a less dangerous and less harmful situation for the peoples of the region." Sayed Hassan Nasrallah added, "In the light of what is happening in Gaza, the Lebanese, Syrian, Jordanian and Egyptian national interests require that Israel emerges from this battle defeated and broken." Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said the exchanges of fire in Lebanon's south would stop when the aggression against Gaza stops. He added, "The resistance's job is to deter the enemy, and our responses will be proportionate." Israel launched a devastating war on Gaza on 7th of October last year after the territory's resistance movements carried out a surprise retaliatory attack dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the Israeli occupying regime. The Israeli military has also been carrying out attacks against the Lebanese territory since then, prompting retaliatory strikes from Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah in support of the Palestinians and their cause. The movement has vowed to keep up its reprisal operations as long as the Tel Aviv regime continues its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The aggression against Gaza has so far claimed the lives of tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians, many of them women and children. The Al Masira television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. A high-ranking official with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says there is no option but armed struggle to fight off the open aggression that the Israeli regime is exercising in the occupied Palestinian territories and elsewhere in West Asia. The Deputy Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Sheikh Naim Qassem, said recently during a ceremony in the western village of Qabeiri, in commemoration of the fallen commanders and members of the resistance group, he said, "When armed struggle has its roots in ethics and faith, and its adherents are willing to make sacrifices, it will emerge triumphant, God willing." Sheikh Naim Qassem said his fellow resistance fighters are attempting to liberate mankind, adding, "Such freedom will come by through sacrifices and out of altruism. We will eventually witness an independent West Asia with the Israeli regime wiped off its face." The Hezbollah official said the surprise operation Al-Aqsa Storm by Gaza-based resistance factions exposed the frailty and weakness of the Israeli regime and drove it closer to downfall. Sheikh Naim Qasem added, "Israel, at the apex of its self-proclaimed prowess, murders civilians and children and is unable to confront resistance fighters. This behavior is indicative of its debacle. After more than 4 months, the axis of resistance is still steadfast and fighting to inflict painful losses upon the Zionist enemy." He said the regional resistance axis is resolved to liberate Palestine from Israeli occupation and aggression, no matter what the cost. The Deputy Secretary General of Hezbollah Movement, Sheikh Naim Qasem, said, "The members of the regional resistance axis is of same and common ideas. All parties have been convinced across the resistance axis that Palestine serves as the compass and that the strong should help out the weak." Sheikh Naim Qasem added, "All the members have reached the consensus that the goal is the liberation of Palestine. We never care about the cost of supporting the issue of Palestine." Over the past several months, the members of the regional resistance axis have been engaged in a common drive against the occupying Israeli regime. Hezbollah, as well as Iraqi and Yemeni resistance groups, have been shoring up the drive by launching numerous operations against Israeli targets as well as American targets in protest at Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. A senior official of the Hamas resistance group says the Palestinian resilience against the Israeli occupation can guarantee a potential agreement with the regime in the Gaza Strip. Osama Hamdan, a senior Hamas official based in Lebanon, hailed resistance as a solution to the war given Israel's long history of non-compliance with its promises. Osama Hamdan added, "The Palestinian resistance against the Israeli occupation is the real guarantee for a potential deal." He also lauded Hamas's Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, saying, "It made Israel and the United States realize that the axis of resistance is able to exert pressure with the aim of supporting movements in Gaza and change the political equations in favor of the resistance front." Osama Hamdan also gave a speech at the opening ceremony of the 24th edition of the Iran Media Expo in the Iranian capital Tehran. He hailed media's role in defeating Israel's narrative in the Gaza Strip, stressing that media coverage is part of the fight against the occupying Israeli regime. Osama Hamdan noted that media coverage is no less important than the war itself on the battlefield, as the Israeli regime is targeting journalists and media activists whose actions are important on the battlefield. Hamdan further stated that after 140 days since the beginning of the war, the situation of the resistance is better than what friends imagine. He said, "Our nation is standing firm," adding that resistance is a major player in shaping the region's future.
It's April 17, 1917. British forces launched their invasion to capture Palestine.
still part of the Ottoman Empire. The battle goes on for 3 days. The casualties on the British side are mounting. They have to retreat. London then recruits Arab tribes, promising to help them shake off the yoke of the Ottomans. With their assistance, the British raid and destroy Ottoman supply lines and logistics in the Palestine region. On the first day of November 1917, the British forces mount a new round of invasion on Gaza. Lack of ammunition and supply cripple Ottoman defense line. Gaza falls into the hands of the British, and by December 1917, they take Al-Quds, but never honor their promise. Instead, the British occupy Palestine until 1948, when they hand over the Holy Land to the Jews, flooding in from across the world. The Palestinian plight and the struggle for liberation begins. On May 14, 1948, General Allan Cunningham, the last British High Commissioner, left what was known then as the Mandate of Palestine. John Marlowe wrote of the last few minutes of British rule in his book, The Seat of Pilate. The Union Jack was lowered, and with the speed of an execution and the silence of a ship that passes in the night, British rule in Palestine came to an end. On the same day, David Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of Israel. It came as a shock to the Arab world. Several Arab countries joined forces to expel the insolent newcomers, but faced a crushing defeat. A neo-colonial project. Israel systematically took over Palestinian lands, expelling people from their homes, and leaving many to live as refugees in isolated enclaves. Official records conservatively estimate that back then, at least 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly removed from their homes and lands by Israeli forces, resulting in the capture of 78% of historic Palestine. The remaining 22% was divided into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The displaced Palestinians entered a state of diaspora, with many spending the rest of their lives in refugee camps. In addition to the conquest of major cities, approximately 530 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and around 15,000 Palestinians lost their lives in a series of large-scale atrocities. Crushed and crestfallen, the Arabs vowed to wreak revenge, take their stolen lands back, and restore their lost pride, honor, and glory. With the rise of pan-Arabic Gamal Abdel Nasser, hope and enthusiasm came back among the Arabs. A coalition of Arab states was formed to go to war with Israel on June 5, 1967. This time around, Israel overwhelmed the coalition in less than a week. The decisive victory included the capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the old city of Al-Quds, and the Golan Heights. The Arab countries' losses in the conflict were disastrous. Egypt's casualties numbered more than 11,000, with 6,000 for Jordan and 1,000 for Syria, compared with only 700 for Israel.
The Arab armies also suffered crippling losses of weaponry and equipment. The Six-Day War also created hundreds of thousands of refugees and brought more than 1 million Palestinians in the occupied territories under Israeli rule. The defeat demoralized both the Arab public and the political elite. Pan-Arabism was defanged, and hopes to take back Palestine were shattered. The Palestinian issue remained unresolved as an Arab problem. Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously claimed in an interview with the Sunday Times on June 15, 1969, that there were no such things as Palestinians. They didn't exist. Almost a decade later, in 1978, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed the Camp David Accords, according to which Egypt would recognize Israel as a legitimate state. A stab in the back of Palestine. Betrayed by Egypt and abandoned by the rest of the Arab world, the Palestinian nation was withering away under the illegal, brutal occupation. Two countries away from Palestine, the Iranian people were making history by toppling the powerful regime of Mohammad Reza Shah, who, like the Israelis, had the United States on his side. The fall of the Shah, who had the biggest army in the Middle East and the fifth greatest one in the world, rekindled hopes in the hearts of the Palestinians. The invincible could be vincible. In the words of the co-founder of Hamas, Abdulaziz Al-Rantisi, we believe that the Islamic Revolution of Iran has had a positive impact on other Muslim countries. It has awakened them, and I believe this awakening accounts for uprisings across the Muslim world. The newly established Islamic Republic was, however, more than a role model for the Palestinian nation. Iran ended its alliance with Israel overnight, in favor of the Palestinians. Just 6 days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the Palestine Liberation Organization chief Yasser Arafat led a 58-member delegation to Tehran. As the first official foreign politician to visit Iran, Arafat was warmly received by thousands of Iranians chanting in support of Palestine. When someone goes to their home, they do not need permission, Arafat told the public during his visit to Tehran. He declared, "Iran's revolution is a great victory for Palestine. When I entered Iran's airspace, I felt like I entered the airspace of Beit al-Muqaddas." Tehran turned the Israeli embassy to the Palestinian embassy and renamed the road in front of it to Palestine Street, an act of symbolic importance. At the same time, founder of the Islamic Revolution, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini, designated the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as Quds Day, calling on all Muslims across the world to mark the day annually in solidarity with the downtrodden people of Palestine. It was a message to the whole world. Palestine is not just an Arab problem. With this spiritual assistance from the charismatic leader of the revolution, Palestine was saved from oblivion. The Palestinian plight came to the foreground. A new lease of life for Palestinian fighters to keep on their uphill battle against the occupiers. The two major Palestinian resistance groups, i.e. the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, PIJ, and Hamas, officially announced their existence in the 1980s. As an underground movement, Islamic Jihad had been found in the late 1970s by Fathi Shaghari, a young physician and a Gaza refugee. Endorsing the Islamic Revolution of Iran, Shaghari said, "This revolution was a wake-up call to us all that our victory is contingent upon following Imam Khomeini's path. So it behooves us to avoid all other ways except the way shown by the Imam in our fight against the occupation regime of Israel." Tehran's ties with the Palestinian resistance groups developed steadily, even when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged one of the bloodiest and longest wars in the region against Iran. Iran's closer cooperation with the Palestinian groups began in 1987 after Israel expelled Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders to Lebanon as part of its efforts to suppress the Palestinian national leadership in the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The raging war against Iran failed to distract the nation from the Palestinian cause. The Islamic Republic expressed its deep disagreements over the so-called Reagan peace plan and the Fahd peace plan, where the rights of the Palestinians had been almost totally ignored in favor of the Israeli regime. Inspired partly by the Islamic Revolution, in December 1987, the Palestinian people staged a sustained series of protests, civil disobedience, and riots, which later came to be known as the First Intifada, or the Stone Intifada, as they were still throwing stones at Israeli soldiers who were armed to the teeth. Amid the deafening silence of Arab leaders, Tehran lent all its support to the Palestinian cause. Imam Khomeini took a clear, strong stance, saying with the Israeli regime in place, the Palestinians would not see the end of their sufferings. In 1993, Fathi Shaghari told Newsday, "Iran gives us money and supports us. Then we supply the money and arms to the occupied territories and support the families of our people." To draw further attention to the pain and suffering of the Palestinian people, a couple of years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian pilgrims began staging demonstrations against Israel and its major supporter, the United States, at the Hajj. Perhaps one thing that sparked the flames of the First Intifada was a tragic incident that happened that year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. On July 31st, 1987, during one of these pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the clash between Iranian demonstrators and Saudi security forces turned bloody, resulting in the deaths of more than 400 pilgrims. Hamas, an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement, emerged out of the First Palestinian Intifada in 1987. It was co-founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and six others, originally as a local offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. On May 2, 1998, Hamas, still a fledgling group with less than a decade since its formation, paid a visit to Tehran to meet the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The meeting happened when almost none of the leaders of the Arab world took the Palestinian Intifada seriously. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, had a different opinion about the struggle, the group, and its leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Iran pledged financial support and provided the group with advanced military training at bases belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran and Lebanon. It also trained Palestinian engineers to manufacture weapons locally. The Second Palestinian Intifada erupted in September 2000, after the collapse of the so-called Middle East peace talks at Camp David and Ariel Sharon's unlawful visit to Haram al-Sharif, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. It was a major uprising by the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation that continued for 5 years. In 2006, Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections, with Palestinian voters giving the group 76 seats in parliament out of the 132 seats available. After the Hamas victory, Khalid Mash'al visited Tehran and said, "Just as Islamic Iran defends the rights of the Palestinians, we defend the rights of Islamic Iran. We are part of a united front against the enemies of Islam." Unlike some other Palestinian groups, Hamas never recognized the occupation regime. So following the group's takeover of Gaza, a crippling blockade was imposed on the Strip to limit the movement of the people and goods, a collective punishment for electing an uncompromising group. To put more pressure, the U.S. and its allies imposed sanctions on Hamas and the community the group represented. Many in the Arab world left the group high and dry, but the Islamic Republic, an all-weather friend, never withdrew its support for the group in the hardest of times. The Shia state gave a hand to the Sunni group to remind the Muslim world that Palestine transcends sectarian differences. On March 9, 2008, a Hamas senior commander, interviewed by the Sunday Times, said 300 of the group's best brains had been secretly sent to Tehran. According to the commander, who wished to remain anonymous, half are still being trained by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. They're learning how to make explosives from everyday items and produce more effective rockets. The rest have already returned from the IRGC base in Tehran. Some have been trained as snipers. Others have learned to use tunnels in attacks on Israeli forces. Iran is our mother. She gives us information, military supplies, and financial support. The resistance movement in Palestine built up steam when Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani took the helm of Iran's Quds Force, one of the IRGC's branches with its main focus on assisting resistance groups in the region. Thanks to Tehran's unwavering support, resistance groups in Palestine grew strong enough to deal the hardest blows on the Israeli regime, something unimaginable after the Six-Day War. For the Palestinians, time for lopsided defeat had gone, and for the Israelis, victory was no longer for granted. Subsequent wars like the one in 2012 left no doubt that the Palestinians had risen from the ashes. During a visit by Hamas leaders to Iran in 2019, Ayatollah Khamenei stated, "Not many years ago, the Palestinians fought against Israel with stones. But today, instead of stones, they're equipped with precision missiles. This signifies development." Struggle against the occupation regime reached its crescendo in October 7, 2023, when Hamas forces launched a land, air, and sea attack into the heart of the Israeli occupation territories, catching the enemy off guard and shattering its myth of invincibility, in spite of all its state-of-the-art weapons and its huge military expenditure. Iran was not involved in the attack, but who can deny the country's decades-long support that molded drone flyers out of the stone-throwing fighters?
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Amid warnings by the United Nations of a looming famine in the blockaded Gaza Strip, which the United States enabled for nearly 5 months, Washington has now embarked on a new public relations campaign. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, three American military aircraft airdropped about 36,000 food parcels over a tiny region with a 2.3 million population, which has been reeling under U.S.-backed Israeli regime bombing since October 7th. Unsurprisingly, U.S. military cameras were on standby to capture the moment when the aid was being loaded into the aircraft at night and the cargo later dropped from the sky. Many rightly saw it as a photo opportunity to mitigate domestic and international public anger for Washington's direct complicity in the worst humanitarian catastrophe currently unfolding in Gaza. The flashlights were switched on to add that extra dramatic Hollywood-style war element to the whole charade, with troops loading the cargo on a C-130 Hercules military jet in the middle of the night. The U.S. Central Command published the videos for global news media outlets, many of whom played along by broadcasting the warlike footage. The Biden administration tried to get a message across that the U.S. military is helping to ease the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza while being the mastermind and architect of their colossal tragedy. The U.S. cargo landed along the Gaza coast, some in the sea itself, and for each U.S. food parcel, hundreds of starving and desperate Palestinians rushed to get a hold of it, drawing criticism from aid agencies and rights groups. Tens of thousands of others walked back to their makeshift tents, hungry and traumatized. For 5 months, they have been struggling to survive amid relentless bombings and crippling siege. The U.S. airdrops of food were inefficient because only small amounts of aid can be dropped at a time from a plane in what was a major operation for all the wrong reasons. It is another darker stain in the history books for the United States regime, which has allowed the Zionist regime to kill and starve families instead of applying pressure on Tel Aviv to at least turn the water taps back on. If the White House was serious about helping the starving Palestinians, Biden could ring Tel Aviv and force the regime to open the land crossings to Gaza for real aid to enter, a key demand of UN agencies. However, that is not the case. The United States regime is directly aiding and abetting this genocide. Historically, in cases such as the Second World War, airdrops were used as a last resort. It shouldn't be a last resort for Gaza today, where the large majority of the 2.3 million Palestinians are on the verge of famine or deliberate starvation, while food and water are a few kilometers away. The Biden administration reportedly sent three C-130 Hercules aircraft over Gaza. One military cargo plane holds the equivalent of one truckload of aid. We keep hearing that Gaza needs an estimated 500 trucks of aid every day at minimum. 500 trucks of aid is the pre-war figure that wasn't enough then. The trucks required today to feed the starving people of Gaza is much higher. Yet, 500 trucks are waiting just across the border in Egypt to enter Gaza, and the Zionist regime with America's backing is preventing them from crossing. They are opting instead for airdrops, which may come across as compassionate to some watching on TV, but the reality is it degrades Palestinians who have been devalued as human beings for nearly 5 months now. Rightly so, the U.S. measures have backfired, drawing sharp criticism from aid agencies and rights groups. Medical Aid for Palestinians said in a statement, "Instead of dropping packages from the sky, some of which end up in the sea or outside of Gaza, and which the most vulnerable cannot reach in any case, the U.S., the U.K. and others should ensure that Israel immediately opens all crossings into Gaza for aid and aid workers to assist those in need." The International Rescue Committee said airdrops are not the solution to relieve this suffering and distract time and effort from proven solutions to help at scale. What makes this remarkably shameful for the Biden administration is that not only has the White House enabled the starvation to be used as a weapon of war in Gaza, collective punishment is a war crime, but it is American weapons that have murdered and starved the Palestinians. The Zionist regime war on Gaza is enabled by arms made in the United States, which is pulling the strings in the war on the besieged territory and using its veto power at the UN Security Council to avoid a ceasefire. These airdrops are also inaccurate, as the US military has no control over precisely where the cargo will fall, leaving the dangerously large pallets parachuted off the back of planes to potentially land on a crowd of people in what is a very densely populated strip. And if they land in the sea, there is a serious risk of Israeli regime warships shooting at Palestinians desperate to collect them, with similar deadly incidents happening many times in the recent past. The UN has warned that famine in Gaza is inevitable unless aid deliveries increase significantly, with a quarter of 2.3 million population one step away from starvation. Starvation has already started to take the lives of Palestinian children. The World Health Organization data shows at least 10 children have been officially registered in a hospital as having starved to death. Highlighting the crisis in Gaza, a WHO spokesperson said, "The unofficial number can unfortunately be higher. The footage from Gaza looks like a powerful natural disaster has hit the territory, but this is nothing natural. The latest decision by the Biden administration highlights how much of a U.S.-Israeli man-made disaster the Gaza Strip has become. This is despite reports surfacing of Palestinians eating animal feed to survive and children dying from starvation as a result of malnutrition and dehydration."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023, a week before the birth anniversary of Lady Fatimah al-Zahra, peace be upon her. This day is celebrated as Women's Day in Iran. Now, in the Islamic Republic, although we have not yet been able to become Islamic in the true sense of the word, I have said this many times that it is only partially Islamic, at the same time, you see that women's accomplishments in the Islamic Republic are incomparable to before. They have made progress in science, in research, in social activities, in the arts, and in sports, among other things. We have so many female scientists, university professors, scholars, and authors in different kinds of writing, including practical writing, artistic writing, fiction writing, poetry writing, and the like. Before the revolution, we did not have even a tenth of what we have today. I was present in the environment of the society, and I am aware of what it was like. Praise God, thanks to Islam, the country is rich in these fields today. This is despite the fact that the Islamic Republic is still a partially Islamic country, as I mentioned earlier, and we have not yet been able to implement Islam completely. If we succeed in implementing it in its complete form, these achievements that we have today will be multiplied many times and our situation will greatly improve.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At the end of our session today, I would like to touch on the matter of the elections. With regard to the elections, I emphasized this matter a few days ago. You ladies and dear women can play a role in the elections. The most important role you can play is inside the home. Mothers can play a role by encouraging their children and their spouses to be active in the elections and to do their research correctly. Women look at issues and find some points more accurately and meticulously than men in some matters that involve recognizing individuals, their strategies, and their ideologies. Therefore, you can play a role both inside and outside the home by learning about the election candidates and going to the polling stations. I am very happy to see you all here today. The meeting took a while and it is now past noon. God willing, you will all be successful. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.